On this episode of Healthcare Happy Hour, we're discussing the key provisions in CAA 2026, some of which will reshape employee benefits and employer-sponsored health plans all the way from transparency and fiduciary risk to new compliance realities for both fully insured and self-insured plans. Let's get into it.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals.
And to help us answer that question, there is no one better than Jennifer Berman. Jen is Chief Legal Officer at Loomlight and a nationally recognized expert on healthcare law and employer-sponsored benefits. Hey, Jen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
All right, so let's start at a very simple, high level. What is CAA 2026 really about?
Well, I think it's about more transparency and continuing to really enhance those rules. So CAA is the Consolidated Appropriations Act. I like to say that that's really all the law we get around here these days is CAAs, and now we have to follow along to see what year we are in. But this one and the section we are talking about today is the 2026 version and relates to a lot about prescription drugs, and we'll talk about the prescription drug reporting that we get here, as well as some new zingers.
New zingers. We like new zingers, actually. I mean, we like them, but other people, you know, maybe not so much. But so staying up at the top level, what's the overarching intent of this section of the CAA?
It really is transparency. So helping for folks to understand and get more information about where their healthcare dollars are going.
So are there changes in plan structure and plan management?
Not really. That's not what this is about. There are a couple of new rules about kind of where healthcare dollars can go. And those are particularly around prescription drug. But this one, this time, is really about giving plan sponsors, predominantly, more information about spend and where those dollars are going.
Are self-insured plans more exposed, or is it across the board?
Self-insured plans are always more exposed, David. that's just a fact of doing business.
True.
But these rules do apply across the board.
All right, so let's start with the transparency requirements. What are the ones that matter the most? What are the ones that are most important?
So I like to think of these in two buckets. So there is significant new rules around prescription drugs and prescription drug transparency. Where are the dollars going in that ecosystem? Now, those rules actually come later in time, but they are the ones that have gotten more press time, more talked about, and they have a much, much higher word count in this bill. So there are many, many more, much more ink spilled on those rules, and there was a lot more talk about them. Now, fewer words, but more coming about more quickly, and in many ways more significant in my mind, is an expansion of the compensation disclosure rules for vendors in this space. So the CAA of 21 included significant compensation disclosure rules for brokers and consultants, but the CAA 26 dramatically expands that to include TPAs, general agents, and really just about any vendor providing services in the health and welfare, in the health plan ecosystem.
So what do those changes look like for each one of those groups? Are they similar or are they dissimilar across each one of those venues that you just mentioned?
They are identical. So when we're talking about the compensation disclosure rules for brokers and consultants that have been in place for really the past 5 years or so, what the CAA of 26 does is to clarify that those rules that required for the compensation being provided to brokers and consultants to be disclosed to plan sponsors now apply to third-party administrators and other vendors providing services to health plans. So the rule was ambiguous before. It basically said for brokers and consultants providing services related to, and then it listed a lot of things, including underwriting, stop loss, compliance services. It had this whole list, but at the beginning of it, it said providing brokerage and consulting services related to. Now the rules have changed and now it says providing these services. So it's now very, very clear that it's not just the brokers and consultants, it's all of the service providers in that health plan ecosystem who are subject to those rules.
So how does that change in practicality what all of those enumerated folks need to be looking at and need to be doing?
So basically it means that those individuals, or really companies, right? The individuals who are those service providers who are providing, who are getting more than $1,000 per year in compensation related to those health plans, need to make sure that they are disclosing all of that compensation, whether that compensation be direct, straight from the health plan, or indirect, some sort of bonus program, third party, really any which way you can get it. We can, I get 100 questions of, is this indirect? I said, is it compensation? Are you getting it? Is it related to the plan? Then it's either direct or indirect. If it's there, if it's money, that's what indirect means. It means indirect. Okay. So if that compensation is happening, it needs to be disclosed. And it needs to be disclosed in advance of the plan sponsor making the decision to engage with that service provider.
And what kind of documentation do plans need to keep?
They need to maintain what that disclosure. And then it, really the best practice is to maintain some sort of documentation that they considered that disclosure in making their service provider decision. So ERISA says that a plan sponsor cannot pay more than reasonable compensation for any service that they purchase. So the idea behind these disclosures is that in order to make a decision that you have paid reasonable compensation, you, number one, have to know how much compensation you are paying. So it's important to know what, you know, what's being paid for the service and how much is going to each service provider in that process. But number two, that plan fiduciary, that individual plan sponsor, needs to be able to demonstrate that they considered it and had some basis for deciding that that was in fact reasonable. So how do you do that? How do you know that it was reasonable? Well, there is no magic blue book out there that you can look up and say, okay, well, here's what the compensation disclosure has, and I look it up in the blue book and here's what reasonable compensation is. I check the box, I'm done. So I would love it if there was that magic blue book, but it's not there. So there needs to be some sort of basis to say, yeah, we sat down, we thought about it, we considered it. And so what does that compensation look like? Well, best practice, or what does that process look like? Best practice is really to have a committee that considers it and to have documented that that committee met, talked about it. Maybe they looked at some sort of benchmarking data, or at least really understood what did they pay and they paid it for what. Here's the services. And here's the amount that they paid for the services. That's where brokers and consultants can come in and providing their expertise. You know, here's the options out there and here's what, you know, industry benchmarks or industry information is providing. But at the end of the day, the key to all of this is process. It's going through some sort of considered process and documenting that process, being able to prove that you, in fact, went through a documented process.
If they're not getting benchmarking data, do they need to get two or three different quotes for the same service?
I think it makes sense to get two or three quotes for the same service. You want to have something to show that you went through and considered what you were doing. So there is, again, there's no magic bullet way to do this. Benchmarking, considering several quotes, something to show that you went through a process. Now, there is no rule that you went with the cheapest one either. But if you don't have some basis to determine that something is reasonable, then there is no way to prove that it is in fact reasonable. So a single quote probably is not enough.
Would you recommend that brokers include benchmarking data with their quotes? Kind of as a defensive mechanism?
That's an interesting question. So that's certainly one way that it could be accomplished to include that benchmarking data with the quotes. You know, I don't know that is certainly one way that a broker could do it. I personally think that probably some sort of third party or, you know, some sort of validated alternative is probably the better way. So I do like the idea of a broker providing some sort of portal or access to or process by which or assistance with getting that information would be helpful, but I wouldn't want necessarily have it come directly from the vendor being hired. So 100%, I think that's fantastic for a broker to provide the benchmarking data to the extent that the broker is helping with hiring or selecting any number of vendors that aren't the broker. If we're talking about the selection of the broker themselves, I don't know that the broker is the best source for that data. If that makes sense.
Oh, but if they cited, let's say they cited Milliman or something.
Yeah, something like that. I think that could be excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to keep other advisors away from the door, or to keep the employer from maybe misunderstanding or maybe understanding and saying, hey, I've got to get a second quote so I can show that we actually considered more than one for the benefit of the plan.
Yeah, that could be a great methodology.
All right. So let's talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Let's talk about PBMs and what changes there are on the PBM side.
Right. So it's important to know with respect to the changes coming on the PBM side that this is a story, and maybe we're on chapter two or chapter three, and there's a lot yet to be written. So we now have a statute that is scheduled to go into effect starting in 2028. We also have proposed regulations that could go into effect as early as this summer, but if I was a betting woman, I would say probably won't. So what do we know? We know that there is substantial pharmacy disclosure coming. We know that it will be a lot and that it will change the game around what plan sponsors know and understand about how pharmacy and prescription drug is paid for in this country. What we don't know is exactly what it's going to look like. So when we look at the CAA and the statute, we can see that the statute includes extensive disclosure, really at all plan sizes, about all sorts of things. Extremely detailed information about really everything and anything that you could want to know or any plan sponsor could want to know, probably far beyond the average plan sponsor's ability to digest about everything about how prescription drugs are priced and what plans are paying for those prescription drugs. We are a long way, actually not that long on the calendar, but a long way. We've got a long way to get from now to there, to that deadline, which is for contracts entered into on or after August of 2028. So it's a long time between now and then, as far as everything that has to get done, including the promulgation of regulations. Those regulations and that statute is different than regulations that were issued just, proposed regulations, that were issued just days before this statute was passed. And we're in the comment period, it's getting ready to end, on those regulations. I don't know if those regulations will, the proposed regulations that came out right at the end of January, it might have been like the last day of January, the first day of February of 2026, will ever be finalized, or if they're going to take the comments that they get on the proposed regulations from the end of January and use them towards creating regulations under the statute. It'll be interesting to see how that all works out. I also can't say for sure, you know, what, if any, impact we'll get from the major PBMs around the statute. What I can say is we do have a statute in play that has massive reforms around what these disclosures will look like. And I'm almost certain that something will happen and we will see significant regulation and change around what gets disclosed in this space. So big change is coming, but exactly what that big changes look like, it looks like, is a story yet to be written.
So business as usual.
Business as usual for just a little while longer, while the PBMs are gearing up for dramatic change, truly dramatic change.
So what does the TPA side of the street look like? Are there been changes there?
Yes. So the TPA side of the street, the big change there is this disclosure thing that we already talked about, right? So they now have to disclose everything about how their compensation works, and that's going to be a major change. Also there, so one element of this, so I mentioned the PBM disclosure piece. That is a major, major change. Also in the PBM provisions is a prohibition on retaining rebates. And the definition of rebates is very broad for that purpose. It's basically retaining any sort of compensation related to the prescription drugs, really anywhere else in the ecosystem, anything coming from the pharmaceutical manufacturers related to steering usage to those pharmaceuticals. That is done both by PBMs and in many cases by TPAs within this process. So those are economic changes to how the system works, not necessarily disclosure-related changes, but big changes to the economics of PBMs and TPAs that will be in the works that they're going to have to work out relative to their business models over the next couple of years. So two big changes there that will impact the TPAs.
If we look at fiduciary risk just at a 10,000-foot level, does this ramp up the pressure? And is there more litigation risk with all of these regulations floating around and these new laws?
Yes. As if fiduciary risk wasn't already at a fevered pitch, it does, because it means that there's all the more disclosure out there for fiduciaries to understand. So the more data in the marketplace that is present for fiduciaries, the higher that standard of understanding that they're going to be subject to. So, you know, I spend an incredible amount of time out there educating plan sponsors on what it is to be a fiduciary and what they need to be doing. And the dirty little secret around that is how much, I don't want to say non-compliance, how much opportunity there is for improvement in the fiduciary space. And so as we see disclosure getting better, more regulation around transparency, more information become available to plan sponsors, that's going to create the obligation for plan sponsors. It's going to heighten those obligations for plan sponsors. It's going to make more become expected of them. And, you know, today, also all too often, the conversation that I have behind closed doors with people is, well, you know, I just can't get the information. So it's not on me that I haven't had my meetings, that I don't understand, you know. I can't get the data that I need. Okay, that may be today or may have been true historically. Well, how does that conversation change when and if the information is available, particularly when, as we do begin to see information become available, it is truly and realistically very hard to digest.
So what do you suggest that advisors do?
I suggest that advisors work with their groups to help set up that fiduciary structure. So there really does need to be a process and a procedure in place for plan sponsors to understand and have a fiduciary committee in place. And many of them have done this in the 401k world. It should not be a foreign concept to them. In many cases, it is as simple as expanding existing retirement plan committees into health and welfare plan committees. Sometimes it's not that easy because it's the wrong people, particularly in larger organizations. The people who've been assigned to the retirement plan committee are the investment folks and the finance folks, and they, like, you talk to them about health plans and their eyes bug out and they're not, you know, they don't want to do it. But in smaller groups, and I mean, sometimes when I'm saying smaller, I mean, like, you know, less than 1,000, not actually small groups. It is the same types of folks who are going to be the committee members, right? It's a head of HR, it's a head of finance, it's a head of legal, who are the people who need to be sitting down and having these meetings and having these conversations around governance of the health plan. So, you know, a good advisor is saying, you know what, let's piggyback onto that meeting. You know, I need 15 minutes too after you've met with your retirement plan people to have these conversations and to make sure that you have governance in place around your health and welfare plan.
So the same kind of deal, quarterly meetings, annual review, documentation up the wazoo.
Yep, I know. Everybody loves a lawyer coming and yelling to them about documentation, but it is, in fact, the same deal.
Any truth to the conversation that's going around that advisors are going, when there are lawsuits, that advisors are going to start being named and they're not going to be tossed out like they were in the J&J suit?
Well, it is certainly the case that there are currently lawsuits pending where advisors have been named and have not yet been tossed out. The basis for that stands on, you know, today, not the firmest of legal strategies. But, you know, here's the deal. Being a fiduciary is a functional definition. It has to do with exercising discretion over a plan. So whether or not you are a fiduciary has to do with whether or not you as an advisor exercises discretion over that plan. So at the end of the day, this comes down to whether or not you are functionally exercising discretion over that plan. So is there truth to whether or not you could be liable for being a fiduciary to the plan? I would ask yourself, do I ever do anything discretionary with respect to that plan? That's a governance question for you and your agency. I work a lot with my advisors in trying to make sure that they stay out of ever doing anything that could make them look, smell, act, or, you know, quack like a duck.
Can you give us an example of what exercising discretion looks like?
Exercising discretion might be, certainly could be making a determination with respect to a claim. That is a perfect example of a discretionary decision, particularly on an appeal or something like that. Really making those decisions about how a plan is going to be administered. So claims are a good example. Some of them, sometimes it's a settlor function. So how much a group is going to pay towards a percentage, you know, we're going to do an 80-20 split, something like that. That's actually not a fiduciary function. That's a settlor function that the employer makes. But when you get into the day-to-day administration of a plan, how that's going to work, like what we're actually going to do through the plan, those are fiduciary decisions. What vendor you're going to use can be considered a fiduciary decision, depending on sort of how is it reasonable compensation? Those types of things can be fiduciary. Not are we going to use a vendor, but making that final decision on what vendor.
So you might draw a line, roughly speaking, between making decisions that are strategic versus making decisions that are tactical.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it.
So is there any upside floating around out here? Is there any opportunity for folks to plans and vendors and also advisors to do more and to do better?
I think that there's tremendous amount of upside. So I very much believe in the employer-sponsored system and that we can do a lot of good for a lot of employees. And having access to this information is extraordinarily valuable, that there's, you know, incredible opportunity to build into and make the system better as you understand this information and understand kind of how the dollars flow. It's kind of a follow the money situation. And the more information you have, the more opportunity you have to build better health plans and to provide better service and better care. I'm an optimist on all of these things. So, I think sunshine's the best disinfectant, and that as you have this information, you can learn a lot and do well by your clients. So I have sat in lots of fiduciary committee meetings and find that, you know, taking the time and having the structure leads to good decision making.
Ultimately, with all of this change and all these new regulations and yet to be written, some of them, who benefits the most from all of this? Is it at the end of the day, the consumer that benefits most?
That's certainly the theory, and done well, I think that is the answer. Now, I fully admit that for the advisors and the plan sponsors, you know, there's hair pulling out moments, and it feels like, oh, it's one more thing to do in my day. But to the extent that it leads to good decision making, I think it really can lead to everyone in the ecosystem doing better.
So for the moment, the advice for advisors is stay tuned, continue to watch this, be educated, work with partners who are careful and who are eager to undergo these new regs and make sure that people understand them.
You make it sound a little bit like I'm a Pollyanna. But yes, I do think that that's the answer. And yes, I do love compliance and I love a good reg. And I recognize that maybe not everybody does. But I do think this presents tremendous opportunity for folks who are invested in the process and willing to dig in.
Is there anything else in CAA 2026 that we've missed that we should talk about, or have we covered pretty much the high points?
I think we've covered the highlights.
Well, that's great. And you are always the best in the universe at explaining complicated stuff to people who are mere mortals such as I. So I appreciate your time. It's been great chatting with you, Jennifer Berman, Chief Legal Officer at Loomlight, and also the recognized national expert on healthcare law and employer-sponsored benefits. Jen, thanks again for your time.
Thank you, David.
You can have the Healthcare Happy Hour podcast downloaded automatically by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also find a link to the podcast in the member-exclusive Washington Update, published on Fridays. For more information on our government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit nabip.org.